This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we want to hear from you about your favorite hobby. You can get us started right now. Share your hobby story over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic prompted Congress and the U.S. Department of Agriculture to offer federal funding and waivers to help provide free school lunches to all students. It looks like that's coming to an end, with the funding and waivers set to expire on June 30th of this year. If the waivers aren't extended, school lunches would return to the way they were before the pandemic, among other changes. The end of free lunches to all students would begin this summer and continue through the fall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a parent or teacher concerned about the end of free school lunches this summer? Is this something that's affected your life, that of your child or your students? Why or why not? Do you think Congress should or shouldn't extend these waivers? What kind of food insecurity have you seen in schools in your local community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jennifer Gaddis is Associate Professor of Civil Society and Community Studies at UW-Madison. She's the author of The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk first of all about what these early pandemic era waivers and changes did. What kind of things happened that weren't happening before?
Sure. So when these waivers were first issued in March 2020, there were huge changes impacting schools, including school closures. So these waivers not only allowed schools to start serving school meals for free to all children, regardless of their household income, but also allowed schools to do really innovative things. So for instance, schools used to actually have to serve meals in a cafeteria or other group setting. Some of these waivers actually allowed schools to be able to send meals home to families. And this was especially helpful for a lot of rural communities in particular. Schools were also able to send more than one day's worth of meals at home at any given point in time. And I think a really crucial thing as well is that these waivers really did allow schools to have more money to cover the cost of producing these school meals. So not only is there this issue with the free school meals the ending, but also there's this issue with having less funding and also a lot more restrictions in terms of how meals are going to be served. And a lot of the supply chain challenges that schools have actually faced throughout the pandemic were things that the U.S. Department of Agriculture had congressional authority to be responding to over time. So actually between March 2020, when those first waiver authorities were granted to USDA, and now over 90 waivers and guidance memoranda, which are essentially instruction manuals, have been issued to local school food authorities. So there's been a lot of flexibilities because this is such an evolving circumstance, but basically all of these things are set to end on June 30th, and schools, even though they're not necessarily functioning like normal, and there are a lot of issues impacting students and households in terms of food insecurity that aren't, you know, going to immediately vanish on June 30th, all of these sort of additional federal supports are going to unfortunately end on that date.
One of the cases for letting this thing lapse is this all started when kids were, in many cases, learning from home. They weren't converging on the schools, so you couldn't really get them meals in cafeterias. The early supply chain issues also part of that. Are things back to normal enough where there's a case to be made that we could go back to pre-pandemic settings for our school lunch programs?
Definitely not. There have been some major surveys by not only the School Nutrition Association, which is the major trade organization that represents school nutrition professionals, but also by organizations like FRAC, which is a major nonprofit that works on a wide variety of anti-hunger issues, that really show that school nutrition directors and programs are facing tremendous challenges. So, for example, I know in some of our larger school districts here, even in the state of Wisconsin, there have been huge labor shortages, somewhere around 30% of employees. So not only are you having these issues with labor shortages, but also a lot of the kinds of supply chain challenges that impact other industries, like being able to get in like new kitchen equipment if an oven breaks down, or even just being able to afford the rising cost of food, are all things that really impact school nutrition programs. programs and really impact their bottom lines. Like, these are not programs that really have a lot of excess cash. You know, oftentimes they're very cash strapped, in particular in districts that have school lunch debt that they have to deal with. So it's one of those things where I think not only are the supply chain challenges going to continue, but also some additional challenges that they weren't facing during the pandemic because of these waivers are going to just really slam school districts in the fall in particular. And there's also some major issues I think that we're going to see already this summer, just with the summer meal programs as well.
Talking to Jennifer Gaddis from UW-Madison, author of the book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools, looking at some big changes as some waivers and funding passed by Congress early in the pandemic set to expire at the end of June. Could lead to a lot of big changes in who gets food, how food is provided to students during the summer and during the school year. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts on this, questions, or maybe a personal experience to share as a student, a parent, or a teacher, or a school lunch provider yourself, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Jennifer, traditionally, I think we think of a lot of free school lunch programs as being need-based to people who need help affording the food. Why did we have this change during these waivers to allow anybody to access this?
Yeah, I think that one issue was that it was just a lot simpler in many ways, particularly with the need to be able to deliver meals in these innovative ways, since you wouldn't be having individual students enter in their student identification number that would link them to whether their household qualifies for free, reduced price, or full price meals. So partly it was an issue of logistics, but partly I think it was also really this attempt to recognize that there are a lot of families, millions of families across the country, and you know, so many even here in Wisconsin, who are right above that threshold for free and reduced price meal eligibility, who certainly faced increasingly difficult circumstances throughout the pandemic in terms of what their household food budgets would look like. We can even see that if we look at food pantries and food banks and other forms of emergency food assistance and how much the demand for that really increased during the pandemic. So I think it was partly really an issue of the logistical convenience and recognizing that food service providers really had like enough going on. So if they could not have to deal with the administrative burden of really sorting students into these different categories, like that would be tremendously helpful. But also really recognizing that there are so many people who really would benefit from this from an economic standpoint, who needed that additional assistance and who I believe really still need that assistance. But one thing I did want to just mention is that when these waivers were extended in the past, they were actually extended multiple times. It was bipartisan agreement. So this was actually something that had support from both parties in Congress. So it was actually a real surprise for a lot of people in the school nutrition community that these waivers weren't extended by at least one additional year. So it's left a lot of people within the school nutrition profession who really, really care about the well-being of students and families in their communities in a really difficult position of trying to figure out how they're actually going to maintain a high quality meal service when school meals not only this summer start up those programs for those districts that offer them, but also when school resumes in the fall. So I think it's putting people in a really difficult position right now.
At a fundamental level, what is the case for schools being a provider of at least a portion of the nutrition for the students who come through their doors?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. And the U.S. is definitely one of the countries across the world that chooses to sort students into these categories of, students whose families have a certain household income will get meals for free, others reduced price, and others paid. So we create this kind of class-based system that not only sorts students based on class, but also in a lot of schools and communities really can have this unintended consequence of creating a lot of not only class, but also race-based segregation in the cafeteria in terms of who's participating in the federal school meal programs and who might be bringing meals from home or purchasing meals if the school has an off-campus like policy where students are able to leave during the lunch hour. So there are so many countries and actually a handful of states now in the United States, so California, Maine, and Vermont, that actually have free school meal for all programs and are really starting to do a lot of work to conceptualize this as a universal right. So something that students just everyone, regardless of income, should be able to participate in as part of the schooling experience. And when that happens, it's really a wonderful opportunity to start building nutrition education and other kinds of food education into the curriculum. And when you don't have a program that really is a universal program, meaning it's a program that everybody participates in, it's really difficult to do that kind of integrated food education. And you also have these huge issues surrounding people really experiencing shame and potentially really feeling like such a sense of stigma that even though they might qualify for free or reduced price meals, they don't want to participate in the program because they feel like it marks them as poor or lesser than other students. So there are tremendous issues that have been talked about really more significantly within the last 10 years around this issue of lunch shaming. And that's this particular phenomenon where school districts may have a certain amount of unpaid meal debt that a student might accrue. And once they reach a certain amount, the school nutrition department has to take some sort of action surrounding how they might actually get a household to pay that money that's owed because they ultimately have to be accountable for it in some way or another. So that has led in the past to schools sometimes having really punitive policies, but there has been a lot of advocacy efforts and some great legislation that have tried to really combat those efforts so that students aren't overtly identified if they do have an unpaid meal debt balance. But that said, students are really savvy and food is really symbolic. So, a lot of students do recognize when they're in the cafeteria with others who is eating the school lunch and who isn't. And that really can be a class marker that can be a deterrent in for participating in the school meals. So I think it's a really important thing to have not only a universal program, but a universal free school meal program. And if we think about it, when somebody enters a public school, we don't charge based on family income for like a math class or an English class or literally any other aspect of the school day. So it's a little bit strange that something as necessary as food to a student's health and well-being and academic achievement would be something that we would charge for based on household income and make students feel that sense of separation from each other.
We're talking about school lunches with Jennifer Gaddis, Associate Professor of Civil Society and Community Studies at UW-Madison, author of the book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. She's with us to talk about waivers passed by Congress through the USDA that gave access to free school lunches to all children. What it might mean if and when those waivers expire at the end of this month. I want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Do you think it sounds like it's time for these waivers to end? Why or why not? What would you like to see change in school districts when it comes to school lunch programs during the school year, during the summer? Do you have personal experiences as a parent, a student, or someone working in the schools or the lunch programs yourself that you'd like to share with us? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Jennifer Gaddis, Assistant Professor of Civil Society and Community Studies at the UW-Madison, author of the book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. She's talking to us about the future of universal free school lunches as a program passed by Congress via the USDA, scheduled to expire unless the funding is renewed and the waivers are renewed by the end of the month. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about these waivers and how they work? Are you concerned parent or teacher or student or school lunch staffer worried about lunches this summer? If you're a teacher, what kind of need have you seen for these free or reduced school lunches amongst your students? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We've been focusing, Jennifer, on the federal level. You mentioned some states experimenting on some of these things. Some legislation was introduced in Wisconsin, I think, by Democrats, didn't pass. Are there things that a state like Wisconsin could do if these waivers and funding aren't renewed?
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned that. So that effort is actually part of a broader coalition called the Healthy School Meals for All Coalition, which is a really exciting multi-sector and multi-generational group of people working together to get free school meals permanently for students in Wisconsin. Yeah, I really encourage people to check out the webpage for that organization at healthyschoolmealsforallwisconsin.org. There are definitely efforts at the state level, including this ongoing coalition. Outside of that, there are actually district level things that can happen. So the primary way that school districts in Wisconsin are going to still serve free school meals for all this summer, it will actually be through the regular summer meal program that will operate in the way it has historically, where any young person under the age of 18 can get a free meal if their school chooses to participate in the summer program. It's really when we go back in the fall that households will have to submit those free reduced price meal applications in order to qualify. But there is a provision called the community eligibility provision, and that will be the main way that schools continue to serve free meals. This program has grown in popularity every year in Wisconsin for the past 9 years and now covers about 468 schools and about 171,000 students across the state. And in these schools, which are primarily, I would say, like high poverty schools, both breakfast and lunch are offered to students free of charge, and schools get a single reimbursement rate back from the federal government. And it's a little bit complicated in that the reimbursement rate is higher, basically the higher the poverty level is for that particular school or district that's participating in the community eligibility program. But there are a ton of schools, hundreds in fact, that are on the edge of making this program work financially. So nearly 100,000 students across the state are actually enrolled in schools that are eligible to participate in the community eligibility provision, meaning they could provide free breakfast and lunches to all students, but those schools are not currently enrolled in the program. So what that means is that there's tremendous opportunity at the local level to try to figure out, well, how could we make that work financially? Maybe it's an additional contribution from the school board prioritizing this as an issue. Maybe it's something for local PTOs to work on or for students themselves to be working on in their own form of youth organizing. So I think that there are so many ways that we're very close to actually being able to access additional federal funding at the district level, particularly for the highest need districts in the state. So that's a really great place to start. But really, any school district can pass a resolution in support of universal school meals and work to prioritize these things. So I think this is something that we can all work on at the district level as well.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Milwaukee. Tim, hi.
Hello. I'd like to comment on the quality, though, of the food that's being served in public schools. We live in Milwaukee, but my kid goes to one of the suburban school districts that's, you know, in fairly good shape financially. And the school menus are just terrible. It is all junk food. It is things we do not serve at home. And our child, who was kind of raised to be, he's 9 years old now, raised to be aware of, you know, what he's eating and why we don't eat certain things. He looks at the menu as well, and there's pizza and macaroni and cheese and things on there. And, you know, he doesn't even, you know, want the school lunch either. He takes it to school. It's a little bit inconvenient for us to prepare that in the morning, but you know, we have far better healthful choices, and it's really not all that difficult to find these things to put in a bag to send to school. And we kind of wonder why the schools can't serve the same thing that we're sending him to school with.
Tim, thanks for the call. That gets to the real food part of the subtitle of your book, Jennifer.
Yeah, I appreciate Tim's question. And I would say that there's tremendous variation from school district to school district in terms of what school meals look like. So all districts that participate in federal programs have to meet a minimum nutritional set of standards. But, you know, in terms of what the actual food quality looks like, that can be quite variable. So I would say that there have been some additional challenges in particular this year. So some things that a lot of parents like Tim might like to see, like salad bars in schools, where a lot of schools might be offering more fresh produce. Those are things that a number of schools didn't really do during like the initial transition back to in-person schooling. So I think that that is something to kind of take into account, that there might be some improvements after we undergo this rough patch of sort of readjustment. But also, if you aren't happy with what school meals look like in your district, I bet that there are others who feel the same way that you do. So what I would really encourage is for people to really work together to try to improve school meals for the benefit of all. And there are some really great tools. The Chef Anne Foundation is one that I really like to point people to because it has an advocacy toolkit that really helps parents who want to see scratch cooked meals and really healthy sort of quote unquote real food in schools understand not only the complexities of school food, but pathways for getting the kind of school meals that you might like to see in your children's schools. So I think that it's really important to be talking with others and really working on this as a collective issue, rather than just feeling like this isn't a system that we can invest in or change. I think that there are so many great examples that we can point to. In fact, in my book, I profile a number of districts that have transitioned away from like the heat and serve model of school meals to doing tremendous things with farm to school sourcing and phasing out the kinds of ingredients that might be concerning to parents that are more conscious about feeding their children like more highly processed foods. So there are a lot of great places that have invested in scratch cooking, which is also significantly better for the workers themselves, I might add. So we have so many examples from rural small school districts to suburban districts to urban districts across the country, a number of which I actually profile in my book, that point to a different pathway forward. So I think it's really just about sort of taking the energy that we have now around universal meals and around like the kind of meals we would like to see in our schools and really working together to make those systems possible in our districts.
Our last few moments, Jennifer, for families with children facing food insecurity, maybe this summer already, can you give us a couple quick resources?
Yes. So you can always go online, and there's also a number that you can text. I would say Feeding America is a great resource to be able to identify what those numbers and summer feeding sites are in your area. I don't know the number off the top of my head, I apologize, but you can text a number and it will give you the different sites around you where free summer meals are being offered. So oftentimes that's not only schools, but other community sites as well. So I think that that's a really important resource for the summer in particular.
Jennifer, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jennifer Gaddis, Associate Professor of Civil Society and Community Studies at the UW-Madison, author of the book The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. She joins us to talk about what it would mean if federal waivers issuing universal free school lunches came to an end this summer. That is scheduled to expire at the end of this month without action in Congress. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, keep kids reading this summer. Kate Archer-Kent gets advice from a youth literacy expert who shares ideas plus some book recommendations. And you can join in with yours, your experiences, and books you'd like to share. That is coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. The movie Top Gun Maverick, starring Tom Cruise, just like the original Top Gun, is bringing lots of people back to the theaters with a big opening day weekend. I haven't seen it, but I just learned something about it. It is the top-grossing super vocalic movie of all time. I saw that in the tweet from the people at Beyond Wordplay, then I read a little further to find out what super vocalic meant. Super vocalic means a word or a phrase, or in this case a movie title, that has each vowel, A, E, I, O, and U, exactly once. So let's check it out. Top Gun Maverick. The O is in top, the U is in gun. Maverick brings it on home with the A, E, and I. The previous top-earning super-vocalic movie, according to Beyond Wordplay, it was Mary Poppins Returns. Added bonus, it has exactly one each of A, E, I, O, U, and Y. Can I do a super-vocalic sign-off here? News up. I rob. A. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Do you have a hobby or maybe more than one? Tell us about it. You are our guest. We want to hear about your hobby. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. There's a huge variety of hobbies out there that people do. Collecting stuff, craft projects, art, woodworking, sports, games. The list goes on and on. Call in now and tell us about yours, your hobby, what it is, how you got into it, what it means to you. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go right to your calls now. Doris is with us in Green Bay. Doris, what's your hobby?
Pen pals.
Pen pals.
I'll tell you, pen pals. I'll tell you how it started. When I was 12 years old, we had neighbors that had a girl 2 years younger than I. She had cerebral palsy. So her father would bring home the Playmate magazine, and I would read it to her. Or when I came home from school, I'd read to her also and other things, and her mother would be busy in the kitchen. So I wrote a letter to the magazine wanting to get some letters for the girl. Well, it worked. And they came by the truck right to the house, even with so much mail, and for her. And then they brought some to me. And that's how my hobby began. And it was 3 cents postage. I was using my parents' stamps at the beginning. Well, I ended up meeting some of the pen pals, and once we, after I was long gone married with that deal, I still have pen pals, and still do have some in foreign countries, which is nice now that we can see and talk to each other on our cell phones. Or
fantastic.
A new way. Now we can see and talk.
That is wonderful.
One girl was born in London on the same day and year as I here in Green Bay.
That's...
So we've compared things with her, and I call her my twin.
That's fantastic, Doris. Thank you so much for getting us started. Wow, a lifelong hobby started at an early age. What is your hobby? Top that one. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Want to hear what you do in your spare time, how you got started, what it does for you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We asked our Wisconsin Public Media colleagues to share some of their stories. Marta Bechtol, Executive Director of the Educational Communications Board, says she has a long history with quilting.
We moved around a lot during my husband's military career, and in 1999 we were moving into a townhouse on Fort Wainwright in Alaska, and a couple of the neighbors came over to size me up, and one of them asked me, "Do you sew?" To which I offered an eager yes, because I've been an avid sewer since I was a teenager. And then the other one turned to me and said, "Do you quilt?" And I said I did not. And then they looked at each other, and then they turned back to me, and they said, "Well, you do now." And that was that.
How about you? Do you quilt or sew or collect or woodwork or you name it? Fill in the blank with your hobby right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Share your hobby story right now. The line is open for you at 800-642-1234. Madeline Fox, WPR education reporter, also loves to sew, mostly apparel, but sometimes bags and purses too. She says, "I love that it connects me to a bigger community of people who sew, both online and in person through my local sewing guild. It's fun to have a hobby totally different from my job that makes me concentrate and try new things and work through problems. And I have something I can wear to show for it." How about you? Call in now at 800-642-1234. I know people are excited about this. We're getting calls on all our other conversations today, people wanting to get into this hobby talk. 800-642-1234 is the number for you to call in now to talk about your hobby. Let's listen to another story from one of our colleagues, Clarissa Johnson, in our audience services department. I hope as a Food Friday fan, given her hobby.
One of my hobbies is cooking. I kind of wax and wane with it as I have more energy, but I really enjoy fermenting foods a lot because most of the time all of the effort is in the setup and cleanup, and then you kind of just let bacteria and yeast do their thing. I also like baking bread a lot when I have the energy. I think there's something a little bit therapeutic about kneading dough by hand if you can, and even if you can't, it's still great to have fresh baked bread in the house. I also used to bake bread with my grandma when I was younger, and so I can feel a little bit more connected to her as well, even if she's hundreds of miles away.
That's a great story. Let's go back to your calls with your hobbies at 800-642-1234. Liz is with us in Columbus. Hi, Liz.
Hey, Rob. I'm a bread baker, and when the pandemic started, I heard about sourdough. All for years, and I'm like, what's the big deal about sourdough? So I'm one of those pandemic sourdough bakers.
Where did you get your starter, Liz, or did you make your own?
I made my own.
Okay. I mean, I've got a brother out in San Francisco, actually, and he was for a while big into sourdough and always had the starter, and then he brought it out to my folks in Michigan, and they had their starter. They've let their starters expire, though. You're still going strong, it sounds like.
I am, yes. In fact, I bake sourdough every couple of days, and my neighbors love me.
Yeah, because that's the great thing about baking. You can bake more than you can eat, so you can make friends by giving away the extras.
The mailman, the Amazon deliver, everybody, they like my bread, so I'll keep baking. And it's cheaper than therapy. Flour is much cheaper than therapy.
Excellent. Public radio hosts like sourdough bread too, Liz. Just I'm going to put that out there for you. Thanks. Thanks a lot for calling in, Liz, at 800-642-1234. We heard from Tracy on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tracy is a fan of woodworking, specifically making cabinets, also vegetable and native plant gardening, making cold processed soap. Oh, I almost said soup. This is soap. Don't confuse the two. Hiking, kayaking, reading, kitten fostering, and cooking. Wow. That's a lot of great hobbies. Thanks for sharing that with us, Tracy. Let's go back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Turtle Lake. Hi, Tom.
Hi, this is Tom Olson. I started making wooden bowls about 3 years ago when I retired at age 75. And we had a big storm here, and now I'm turning all our dead trees into wooden bowls and really enjoy it. And I found that there's a lot of other men my age that have retired in the area that are doing the same thing. Cool. It's just a phenomenon.
Is it basically like whittling? What's your toolkit for making wooden bowls? A lathe?
Like a lathe, yeah.
Okay.
We turn them.
Excellent. How many do you reckon you've made so far?
Oh, two or three dozen, I guess. I give them away to the family members.
Excellent, Tom. Thanks a lot. That is a great hobby. I love it. Thanks for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Heather joins us now in Madison. Heather, hello.
Hi.
Hi, what's your hobby?
First time caller. My hobby is an online pedigree database for Wisconsin State Dog, the American Water Spaniel.
So you maintain a website about the American Water Spaniel?
I maintain a website, and I have a pedigree database that has all of the dogs going back to the founding dogs from 1938.
Wow. Now, probably anybody who wants to know about this has found your website, but just in case, Heather, somebody wants to know more about the pedigree of their American Water Spaniel, how are they going to find you?
ScaniBrownDogs.com.
ScaniBrownDogs?
BrownDogs, yes.
.com.
If you can imagine, Wisconsin State Dog comes in one color, brown.
I love it. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Heather. That's a cool hobby. Wait a minute. Are you still there, Heather?
I'm still here.
Do you have one or more American Water Spaniels?
I currently have two. I've had one by my side for more than half my life. They are the best breed. Under 50 pounds, curly brown, floppy ears, super fun.
Wonderful. I'm glad I remembered to ask you that. Thanks for calling in, Heather. We are taking your calls about your hobbies. We want to hear what you do for fun and recreation. Arts, crafts, collections, activities, you name it. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're taking your calls about the hobbies in your life. You can join in and share yours at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. John is with us in Kenosha. John, hi, what's your hobby?
My hobby is competitive trap shooting. I do it with my team.
And how far have you traveled to go to competitions?
I've traveled to Cincinnati, Ohio.
Mm-hmm. Is your team pretty good?
Yeah, we've placed first in states and third in nationals.
And it sounds pretty fun. Is it? I mean, A, it's a fun activity. Is it pretty cool to do it as part of a team?
Yeah, it really is, because you get to meet new people and stuff.
Cool. John, thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Want to listen to another story about hobbies from a WPR colleague? This is Alyssa Benno with PBS Wisconsin.
I love giving new life to old furniture, whether it's family heirlooms or thrift store finds. My orbital sander is my favorite toy. This old house is my favorite resource. And my favorite way to spend an afternoon is in the paint and stain aisle at the hardware store. It's a hobby that forces me to slow down. I've learned the beauty of real wood, the importance of pre-stained wood conditioner, and why you shouldn't use an orbital sander in the basement, unless your favorite thing to spend money on every 2 weeks is home air filters. It can be meticulous, like the process of refinishing a 100-year-old hand-carved dining set that was passed down in my dad's family. But when I had finished it, my favorite thing wasn't how beautiful it turned out. It was hearing my dad and his siblings share memories of the meals they had at it while growing up, and knowing that now that it's in my own kitchen, I'll get to do the same.
It's a great story. We are taking your calls about your hobbies at 800-642-1234. Bob joins us now in Two Rivers. Bob, what is your hobby?
My hobby is collecting miniature anvils.
Miniature anvils? I didn't know that was a thing.
Oh, it's a big thing. Just Google miniature anvils and you'll have all kinds of time to spend with them. Anyway, I'm an amateur blacksmith or a wannabe blacksmith, and I started collecting little anvils about 30 years ago. And since 1997, I've had cast over 4,000 anvils with over 200 different names of people, places, and events on them. I own the patterns, and I change the letters, and the little foundry in Collins, Union Brass and Aluminum Foundry, they do all my casting, and I just finish them. And there's a big network of anvil collectors all over the country.
Cool. Okay, I did exactly what you said and looked it up online. I'm seeing, yeah, they're like, some of these guys are 2 pounds, because I think anvils, I think, really heavy. Not these are really little, though.
You'd look up mini anvils.
Yeah, yeah.
M-I-N-I.
Oh, okay.
Mini anvils, yeah.
I just look miniature anvils. Okay. So how many do you have sitting around now?
Well, of the thousands or the 200 different names I made, when I make a order, I save one of each one. So if I get another order, I know how to set the letters on them, because the tedious job is changing the letters on the pattern. Little aluminum letters get epoxied to the part A and part B pattern, as I call it. And then take them to the foundry and he casts them. And then I bring them home and I have a little machine shop. I grind the top and the bottom and put the hardy hole is this, the square hole, and the Pritchell hole is a round hole, and they have to have that. And
wow.
They just, but at my own collection, I've had about 600 of them.
And
I'm getting to where I got to start parting with some of my treasures, so they're going by the wayside, some of them.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Wow, that was the thing I didn't know existed, mini anvil collection. Thanks, Bob, for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Robert joins us next in Sheboygan. Robert, hi.
Hi. I collect Magic the Gathering cards, and
you know, Magic was has been a big thing for years, and I actually stopped playing in 1996, but got back into it when I was older. I play old school Magic, so only older cards, but I travel all over the country now, and I get to, you know, meet all these people that I never would have before, and we all have this kind of shared passion for playing this game that we played when we were children. There's a lot of nostalgia involved with it.
Oh, yeah. Now, I'm a big game player. I've played Magic back in the day. Playing games and collecting games, they sometimes run afoul of each other, Robert. How do you preserve the cards that you're also playing with?
Well, you know, I collect a lot of these things out of nostalgia, even if I don't play the actual card. But, you know, in my opinion, these cards were meant to be played. So even if there's a chance I might injure the card by actually playing the game, you know, I want to see that card on the table, and I want to see my opponent's face when I actually get that card out there and play it, even if they haven't seen it in 20 years.
Robert, thank you so much. I'm on the same page. I think they're meant to be played, so I don't wrap them up in plastic or anything like that. We are taking your calls about your hobbies at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Parker joins us next in Janesville. Parker, what is your hobby?
I go cycling, and I've been getting into doing bike tours with a group of friends around Wisconsin.
Ooh, what are some of the highlights of your tours?
Last summer, we did a four-day tour from Janesville to Potosi and back, and we hammock camped. So, hiking for 4 days.
You're breaking up, but you answered the question I was going to ask. Hammock camping along the way. I wonder if that was like you're biking from motel to motel or campsite to campsite. I get it. Parker, thanks a lot for sharing that. Sorry we lost you there. 800-642-1234 is the number to call and share your hobbies with Central Time and the world. Dale is next in Madison. Hi, Dale.
From Appleton.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dale in Appleton. I think our producer misheard you there. But what? More importantly, what is your hobby?
Woodworking.
What kind of things do you do?
You name it. I started with the simple stuff like burrows and other simple things like that. And the Holy Spirit gives me a lot of really unique, awesome ideas and stuff. And I make some really cool stuff. Summers, I couldn't find it, but I have a list that's almost 40 things long of different things I've made.
Wow.
And stuff. And I can do pretty much anything with wood. So wood is pretty neat. You can, depending on what type it is, you can make stuff with really super hard wood if it needs that ability and
cool.
To stay old. Or you can use cheaper pine or whatever for other softwood stuff.
Wow. Dale, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. A lot of great wood projects. Thanks for calling in from Appleton, Dale. I appreciate it. Elizabeth joins us next in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, I collect hiking medallions ever since I was 5 years old. They go on my hiking stick that I've had for that long.
Where does one get a hiking medallion?
I get them from state parks and national parks. Every time I go, I will always find one, and they're actually in order from the, like, from the first one I've visited to the last one.
Oh, so. Cool. So how do you store them or display them in order?
So they attach to my hiking stick that I'll take, and one day once it's completely filled up and I can't add anymore, I plan on hanging it and having it just be a memento of all my travels.
Awesome. Wow, what a great way to remember your trips, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. I love it. We are taking your calls for another few minutes with your hobbies. Share them with us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Eli is up next in Madison. Hi, Eli. What's your hobby?
Hi there. I collect Civil War relics, bullets, belt buckles, that kind of thing.
Wow. How do you find them? Do you go to conventions, or are there dealers, or how do you track those down?
Yeah, it's kind of a mix. I like to go to a lot of battlefields when I travel. So when I go there, I check out antique shops in the area. I'm real particular about provenance, where they come from, mm-hmm. and who found them. And then, I just have a nice collection. I'm down to 3 giant cases now. So
you've been pairing it down a little bit?
Well, I'm just trying not to collect as much until I get more space, but it's hard not to. So.
All right. Thanks for sharing that, Eli. John is with us next in La Crosse. John, hi.
Yes, hello. How you doing?
Good. What's your collection or your hobby?
I collect Pez dispensers.
Cool. What are some of the highlights of your Pez dispenser collection? I know there's a zillion of them out there.
Yes. I started in 1997 or so. My children, I gave a couple to my children, and since I started collecting them, got about 5,000 in my collection. My favorites, it's hard to say. They used to start out with only a couple a year, but now in the last several years, it's just getting kind of ridiculous, actually. But
John, that sounds like a great collection, 5,000 pieces. Time for another caller or two. Paula is on the line in Green Bay. Paula, what is your hobby?
Well, I'm a geologist, so I decided that one of the things I was going to do was collect a rock from a specific formation from every county in Wisconsin.
Cool. Are you up to 72?
No, I'm at about 26.
Okay. Oh, your work's cut out for you then. Thank you. Paula, time for one more caller. Cameron is with us now in Green Bay. Cameron, what's your hobby? Oh, we lost Cameron, but I have a note that says playing Dungeons & Dragons was Cameron's hobby. We heard from Jacqueline on Facebook who says hobbies include cooking and baking, playing the hammered dulcimer, and singing in church choir. Jacqueline says they're retired, so hobbies help give purpose for life and a reason to get out of bed in the morning. Thank you, everybody, for sharing those great stories. A lot of great hobbies in there. Wish I had time to do them all. I got a few of my own, though. You can keep sharing your hobby stories, though, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I could share them over the rest of the week on the show. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at the role state and tribal governments play in pipelines after a move by the Biden administration to give them more authority. And large-scale livestock farms can have a big impact on small communities in Wisconsin. We'll check out a new report. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, gas prices hit another record high yesterday. We'll talk to an energy market researcher about the effort to bring prices down. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.